Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza box pints.
My wife's cakes are selling up hot cakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon, welcome to Flavour, and our thanks to Ollie for the sports special. I'm Alan Alder, I'm here in my house, and Matt Bentman and Sue Bailey are in theirs. And through the miracle of technology, we've put a programme together. Sue?
Today we have Tim Hayward looking at the effects of coronavirus on the food and hospitality industries, Laura Donoghue has a thought-provoking Easter essay, and our resident chef Rosie Sykes has some ideas for rhubarb.
Dave Fox has some ideas for growing your own if you don't have a garden, and our very own Sue Bailey delves back into the history of English cooking with some dishes for Easter.
And throughout the programme, we'll be keeping you up to date with the local food news. But let's begin with Tim Hayward. We spoke on Skype a few days ago, and I asked him about how the lockdown is affecting food businesses.
I think I look at this from two different angles. I mean, obviously, I'm on my sort of national beat. I'm wired in with all sorts of different people who are looking at this different kind of levels. And then in Cambridge, I'm, you know, right in here running a business at a very sort of grainy level. The appearances are quite different. I think we as a business feel very resilient because we've always run in the black. We're established, and it's been a fairly clear cut thing that our commercial bakery will keep going with staff being paid. We are retailing bread. We've stopped trying to do it ourselves because it wasn't our area of expertise, but there are plenty of really, really good operations distributing. So we make, we give it to them, they distribute, and there's no reason we can't keep that going. As long as the flour and the yeast hold out, that's fine. But the other businesses we've furloughed, and obviously we have college landlords, which most of my colleagues in other parts of the countries don't have. So they're rigorous. They're not, nobody's generous, but they are rigorously on message about how they deal with this, and they're being good. So that's my experience of them has been that. I'm hooked into a couple of things, really. I suppose on the sort of national paper level, there's obviously got a lot of backroom discussion going on about the forthcoming stuff for the industry. There's also a couple of sort of industry player WhatsApp groups that I'm tucking into. That's people who are running big chains, mid-levels, the large-scale independent chains, and then the very, very small things. And it's looking really complicated right the way across the board. I think one of the truths I've always known about the restaurant industry, and you'll have seen this too, is when you drive past a place or you read about a place and you see that it's absolutely full of people and it's really doing well and it's getting critically acclaimed and everything else, you have literally no idea whether they're minting it or whether they're going from penny to penny, massively, massively over-leveraged with huge borrowings. So some of the large chains, some of the medium size, set up by ordinary guys, 8 to 10 branches chains, some of the small, we've got 2 restaurants, some of the independents, they're all the same kind of problem going along, which is those of them that were weak going in won't survive it. Those of them that were almost unbelievably well squared away and solid will survive it. And in between it, it's going to be nuanced as to how they handle it. I mean, the most recent figures I saw this morning was they're talking about a fifth of the catering industry across the board, on average, not making it through. If that's true, then there's 20% more staff available. Then you subtract the Southern Europeans who may not come back. The government assistance with payment scheme for furloughing, etc., great. We are extraordinarily good about paperwork, and I've got a fantastic financial director. Alison is just brilliant on that kind of thing. But they have spent the last 7 days absolutely with their heads in the government paperwork, trying to do the really, really simple thing of transferring that money straight through. What the government's done has turned us into the Dole office for our own staff. Probably a smart move in the current environment because they couldn't ramp the rest of it up. It would never work. It's fine, but it's not easy. And if we can barely do it, looking out at the smaller, our brothers and sisters and the smaller independents who don't have that kind of level of business background or can't afford that kind of level of business support. I have no idea how they're going to pull that together. I mean, some very good friends in London have a chain of restaurants, which, because they were so good at what they did, so efficient, so brilliant, in the last year, enormous numbers of people have given them, lent them tremendous amounts of money to open 8 new branches. They've just about turned the key on the last one when COVID hits. And it's down to what their investors want to do to them now. So there's another side to this, which is how you respond as a business. I think a lot of companies have, certainly in London, where it is infinitely worse than it is in Cambridge, they've pivoted, as they says the term is, we've pivoted to delivery. And a lot of them pivoted to delivery, and they've gone quietly off delivery a week and a half later because they're simply not set up for it. And it's a lovely thing to do. And very often these are small operations run by a charismatic restaurateur or chef who either, full marks them, has an eye to the optics of what it is that they're doing publicly, or is a genuinely phenomenally good human being who wants to do great things for the people around him and for his own business and for his own people, etc. That's fine. But you can only keep it going for a certain period of time if it's not your business. As we've found out ourselves, finding drivers, vans, setting up databases, organising, even letting people know you can get stuff to their door is staggeringly complicated.
What about things sort of slightly more long-term? When people can go back to work and therefore cafes and restaurants can open up again, is there going to be a lag in food supply?
Supply is interesting. So in farming at the moment, apart from fruit and veg and the picking part of it, which is a separate political agenda that's kind of a tail end of the Brexit argument, I think before the first year of inability to actually gather the crops in because of Brexit had actually happened, we've gone into this and we're starting to hit it at the same time. So we don't really know what to blame that one on. Yeah, I think we do actually, but officially we don't know what to blame that one on. So there's that stuff. But I think, for example, the flour supply system is just vast. I mean, we have got millions and millions of tons of flour in and wheat in silos, bought years in advance because of it, on that basis of price. No problem with that kind of stuff at all. Big trucks to get it to bakeries. The only problem we ever have is the sort of the microeconomics of the fact that every supermarket in the country now is desperately trying to get packet yeast because they sold out last week. Their algorithm is ordering more. They've got huge buying power to go to the companies that grow yeast and say, okay, right, we'll take all the yeast you've got and we'll take it at this price. And they'll go, okay, fair enough, fine, and then that goes, it's all that yeast for the next 2 weeks will be going out in tiny packets to idiots who don't know how to make bread, and want to stockpile it. And I'll be making videos for the FT, but here's how to make a simple loaf of bread. The food will come in. It's the supply chains and how people can actually get to pick it up at the other end. So last week it was queuing at supermarkets. The week before that it was going to be delivery. The delivery companies had stopped opening new slots. The supermarkets started allowing less people in. The independent stores. Mill Road is an absolute goldmine. I mean, you can buy anything you want in Mill Road. Interestingly, I think a couple of independent shopholders I've spoken to have said, of course, we go to independent suppliers. They're buying it at whatever price the market needs because we know we can sell. We're passing those prices on to the customers. Yes, prices are gently going up, but we can do that. Whereas the supermarket actually can't. The really interesting thing, for the first time ever, if Waitrose puts 2p on a loaf of bread this week, they are. That would be profiteering. It's not profiteering when the market does it through small independent purchases, independent shops. I mean, obviously, I'm steeped in food history. One of the things I always find fascinating about rationing during the war, it was very rigorous for the poor and the law-abiding lower middle classes. But pretty much throughout the war, you could get whatever you wanted. It was just a matter of where you went for it and how much you paid for it or how long you waited or how connected you were. And you can judge that as being a good or bad thing or just a pure part of market forces. But it's there. And I think when you go to a supermarket now, this week you have to queue at 2 metre intervals, and it takes you a very long time to get in, and you'll be hearing online which are the easy supermarkets to get into and who's got what. But when you walk in, you don't see across the board scarcity, you see holes in the facings. And the holes change week by week. First week in my local, I live close to the Waitrose out in Trumpington. First week I went, just after the lockdown, to do my first shop, it being middle class, they'd run out of chickpeas and tinned tomatoes. And just as you'd expect. You know, next week I went back, loads of chickpeas, still no tinned tomatoes. Next week, you know, you walk in and you can't get into the aisle because there's two forklift pallets of Dormio tomatoes stacked at one end. And it's just like, it's not even human error that's causing these supply chain problems. It's actually algorithms that are doing the just-in-time ordering. It seems extraordinarily unlikely, I mean, vanishingly unlikely, that the entire nation is going to be on this level of lockdown in August. I think the only thing you can do as a business strategy at the moment is sit tight, mothball. You know, I'm going around the premises once a week just to make sure we don't have any kind of infestation. So, you know, you go in, you check the property. You know, that's what we'll do. We have stabilised to throw away a staggering quantity of food. That was painful. And the only time I really sort of emotionally broke down was just putting unmarked bags of coffee in the skip. I phoned every available place, you know, and it was the only laugh on the occasion, which was, yeah, you know, we're delivering to people. I don't think they have coffee grinders. No, I don't think they do. I don't know what to do with that. I kicked the bin to death and had a little weep, and then that was it.
Once things get going again, is there going to be an issue with staff availability? I mean, obviously, a lot of people are leaving the UK because the UK is leaving Europe. So that's a difficulty I think we've been coping with. But are people leaving the UK or wanting to leave the UK or have left the UK because of coronavirus?
I can only speak in a very non-specific way about people in my own business. Most of the people with families in other European countries were asking us whether it would be possible to return home fairly early on. We have had a lot of Southern Europeans at the moment we had a fair number. Obviously, it was hitting them earlier and faster. They wanted to get back home. They left in a sort of fairly orderly manner.
But will they return?
I have no idea where Brexit will be by that point. If it keeps going at the rate it's going, which the government seems fairly intent on doing, then by the time we're recovering from this, that option just won't be open to us anymore. It would be nice if it was only the people that didn't want to come back that didn't come back. I don't know. I mean, I've been reporting on this now for the last two decades. The fantastic growth of really, really committed, lovely small businesses. Independent players who've, you know, given up their rat race jobs or retired or used all their savings or something like that to set up some small, you know, coffee shop, bakery, cake operation, home catering. They've set themselves up as private chefs or you know, and these businesses are the ones that we may lose a lot of those where it kind of doesn't matter to them and it doesn't matter to anybody. That might be nice. Those that really, they were kind of dabbling and actually it was going to be like too much like hard work anyway, and that's fine. In the independent sector, I think you have this sort of 5-year itch feeling whereby people get into it. And by about year 5, when they realise actually it's not going to make them a fortune. And lifestyle-wise, it's really no easier or harder than working in the bank in the city where they used to. So, nah, forget it. So I think a lot of that, and those obviously won't survive. Nobody will go through this and want to come back if it isn't. And there's some that shouldn't be around, I suppose. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be ugly, but it's going to be over. Actually, it's going to be over, and people will always want to eat, and people will always want to drink. The one thing that stuck with me through my entire sort of writing and journalism career is an interest in hospitality. Not the hospitality industry with a capital H and a capital I, but hospitality. And, you know, when I review restaurants or when I write about food or I write about sort of families eating behaviour and all the way through this sort of stuff, it's still that thing, that small H hospitality, the human desire, the human urge to cater for each other and to have a good time around food and drink. That persists through everything. And the one thing I can guarantee won't be problematic is that we'll still have that when we come out. And the other thing that I am noticing in a slightly cynical way as we go through the process is the longer this drags on, the more our desire to express that and do it when we come out is going to be there. Absolutely. We want to go out and we want to have fun. So, yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed for that and be ready to cook when it happens.
Thanks to Tim Hayward. Yes, we really will be pleased when this is all over. But since we recorded that interview, Cam's Cuisine have announced the permanent closure of St John's Chop House in Northampton Street. A nice place and a sad loss.
And Tim Hayward's new book, Loaf Story, will be published on the 17th of September. On to something more uplifting. Rhubarb. Alan tells me that the best-looking rhubarb to be found in Cambridge is on the Brownfield Farm stall on the Sunday market. Now, wherever you get yours from, here is Flavour's resident chef, Rosie Sykes, with some tips for getting the best from it.
I'm a massive fan of rhubarb. Yes, and I've been lucky enough to be able to get some even in this lockdown situation, but what I'm dying to do is grow some, actually. And I have been promised a crown from somebody, so I'm waiting very keenly for that. But in the meantime, I think one of the best ways to cook rhubarb is not to add any liquid to it at all. Wash it, and any water that clings to it is the only water you will need when you cook it. And then what I do is cut it into sort of 3 or 4 centimetre pieces. Then I weigh it, and I probably put in about somewhere between 10 and 20% of the weight in sugar. So if it's a kilo, I would put about 200 grams, but maybe nearer to 150. It kind of depends. If it's the really pale pink indoor forced stuff, I would definitely put less because it's much sweeter naturally. The outdoor stuff is a bit sharper. And you may even need to put a tiny bit more than that in. But then what I do is I just toss the sugar through the rhubarb, and the sugar will sort of stick to the rhubarb because of the water. And then if I've got some rose water or orange flower water or vanilla pod, I might put that in. Put it in an oven tray, flat in one layer if you can. Cover it really tightly with some foil. And I put it in a very low oven, so probably about 120, and leave it to cook for, I check it normally after about 20 minutes. And if you should be able to catch it, probably won't be ready after 20 minutes, probably another 15. It sort of depends on the thickness of the rhubarb and so on.
Yeah.
But by doing it like that, you can normally catch it while it's still lovely pieces of rhubarb that are soft to the touch but don't completely fall apart but do when you eat them. But they are whole pieces and you'll have lots of lovely liquid. And I find that's really delicious. And generally, you have so much liquid that you can kind of use it as a cordial. So it's lovely for in a glass of fizzy water, or as a little aperitif in a glass of fizzy wine, or with some gin. So very nice things for lockdown, I would say. And I also think rhubarb is really great with a bit of pink grapefruit. So I sometimes, if I had one of those about, might squeeze that in, half of pink grapefruit or a ribbon of the peel in when I cook it. But I also think rhubarb pickles really nicely. And then it's really delicious with some oily fish like mackerel or sardines, grilled sardines or smoked eel, if you could get hold of that. I've actually been getting, there's a really nice smoked mackerel in a tin, and which makes a lovely little sort of, you could just mash it up with some yogurt or cream cheese and make a little pate and have it with pickled rhubarb. So what I do for that is do pickling liquor, which is half the amount of sugar to vinegar, and then aromats for rhubarb. I would use a bit of citrus peel of any kind, finely grated, some coriander seeds, some fennel seeds, and maybe even a few chili flakes, depending on your personal preference for that. And then I would cut the rhubarb up like I would for the baking in the oven, just put a little bit of salt on it and put it in a colander. And some liquid may come out, but it may not. But it just sort of gives it a nicer texture. And then I would simmer the pickling liquor, leave it with the lid on over a very low heat just to infuse for about 15 minutes, but not simmering or anything. You don't want it to reduce. And then while it's still warm, I pour it onto the rhubarb, not boiling hot, but warm. Pour it onto the rhubarb and then leave it for a week or so before using it. And that would be really nice with pate as well, a lovely, you know, pork tureen or some ham. It's a really nice thing, I think.
And Rosie's new book, Roasting Pan Suppers, will be published in September. Some food news now. Van der Lyle has restarted its home deliveries. Bookings open at 10 a.m, 7 days in advance of the delivery date, and you can book via their website, a bit like Glastonbury all over again. Seatree, the upmarket chippy in Mill Road, has no contact deliveries and collections. Again, you book via their website. But now something to settle back and give a really good listen to. It's Laura Donoghue's Easter essay.
The solemn strangeness of this year, and for those of us who aren't managing far worse, the preoccupation with running out, brings back memories for me of another Easter, one I spent in Denmark many years ago as a 17-year-old exchange student. The 6 months I spent in Denmark at that formative age changed my life, and among the moments that stand out most is a meal I was fed on Easter Sunday. It meant much then and has become emblematic sense for me of being lost and found, of salvation. I was backpacking on my own across the continent over the 2-week Easter break, which was a novelty to me as an American. I had gone rather haphazardly to France, Germany, and Switzerland. I don't remember the chronology, and the letters home are lost. I managed not to realize that European banks would be closed for several days and found myself without food or money. I was a well-cared-for young person whose parents had had the courage to let me take off for a foreign continent in the days when there were no mobile phones, no ATMs, no email, just snail mail, Western Union, and leaps of faith. I was a middle-class kid on a scholarship, not a child living in poverty. Nevertheless, I experienced hunger on that trip. I had run out of food by Thursday and was expecting, after only one fast day, to replenish supplies on Friday. Long Friday, I learned it was called in my host country. When I realized there would be no remedy until the following Tuesday, I headed back to Denmark like a lost dog. I had a rail pass, so nothing needed to be spent to cover those miles, and I chose an overnight sleeper train so I wouldn't have to face a night without accommodation. It was cold waiting in those drafty stations, and I got ill with something feverish and shivery. I spent a miserable time collapsed on the floor of the train's toilet in desperate straits, other desperate passengers pounding on the door. I didn't head straight back to my home from home in Copenhagen, as we were meant to vacate our rooms over the holiday to give our host families a break. So I headed to a farmhouse youth hostel on Jutland, which I'd read about in my backpacker's guide with a fancy to its rural location when I was still well enough to pick a destination. Getting there also involved a rural bus journey and a long walk down a country road. When I finally got to my destination, exhausted and feverish, the youth hostel was closed, off season until the 1st of May. More bad planning on my part. But the landlady was home. This was a family farm operation, and she must have seen something in the situation that couldn't be refused. She let me into a freezing dormitory in a complex some way from the house, where I had my pick of 4 metal bunk beds with thin blue blankets. I was grateful for this and too shy to ask for more. There was a sink in the room, and I ran the water as hot as it would go, plugged it, and used my tea ball, a quixotic bit of kit I carried with loose tea, to brew a lukewarm English breakfast, which I gratefully sipped from cupped hands. I stole the covers from all the other bunks and stayed in bed for 2 days, sipping my brew when I could, but feeling worse as time passed instead of better. I began to be obsessed by hunger, too weak to do anything about it. I woke on Sunday to the sound of children playing in the farmyard and realized it was Easter. I couldn't bring myself to interrupt the family holiday, but by that evening realized things were getting desperate and that I needed help. I screwed up my nerve to knock at the farmhouse door and asked if it would be possible for me to buy some food if I came back later with the money. The woman seemed concerned, and her kindness encouraged me to admit I was ill and hadn't had anything to eat since before Thursday. By this point, I was ready to beg. She brought me into the kitchen, a warm, steamy place where food smells almost made me faint. I sat at her working table with a mug of properly hot tea and smiled at the children whose questions I couldn't summon my nascent language skills to understand or answer. Some minutes later, she set before me a clean white plate and placed on the table a large platter of pink Danish ham, thickly sliced and plentiful, boiled potatoes, about a dozen of them, peeled and pale gold, and a mound of soft white asparagus. She collected the children and discreetly left me to dig in, which I did with more than ordinary gratitude. With the fervent thanksgivings of a saved soul, I took in the warmth, the smells, and the food itself, potatoes crumbling in my mouth, ham salty and sweet both, asparagus tasting of life, with the sensation that eating was a miraculous discovery, a novelty I would never take for granted again, now that I understood how precious it was. I ate and I ate, and as my hunger was sated and I comprehended the vast quantity I had eaten, my teenage embarrassment suddenly returned, and I feared I must have misunderstood and eaten what had been set out for the entire family. I sat in a panic, my heart now in my mouth, ready to bolt with mortified apologies, but also with the last two potatoes wrapped in a napkin for later. My kind rescuer returned after a decent interval and met my anxieties with the assurance that the generous platter had indeed been intended for me alone. I was touched that she had yet one more gift for me, a slice of ice cream decorated with green-tinted coconut and 3 jelly beans, a little Easter nest for the children, which she had the wisdom to see would charm me too. I was moved to be included in their celebrations, or so it felt, to be reminded of my sisters and cousins who would that day be delighting in their Easter baskets. The ice cream soothed my throat, though I was no longer hungry and didn't really need it, and I went back to bed feeling safe again, knowing I would never forget the feelings of that long weekend, nor the kindness of those strangers. I've been thinking of this long-ago Easter, not just because it's Easter, but because I've been helped by so many people these past days, when getting food has been such a trial, and I felt needed by them too. The neighbor adding a pint for me to her order with the milkman, a gift of bread flour from a friend, which I in turn halved with the kind person who shared their milk delivery, a few apples swapped for some potatoes. Never have we been more aware of the debt we owe to those who feed us, to everyone in that long chain of mutual dependency. The organic grower whose produce I've been buying at the market for years has this week started doorstep deliveries in our area of staples boxes, potatoes, onions, carrots, cooking vegetables, salads, and herbs. They had a frantic first day of the scheme, harvesting, packing, and finding all of us, while also trying to get the next crops planted or weeded. And the franticness for them won't end there. Taking on this massive new effort helps them too when their regular outlets have closed, but it's so dependent on good people being willing and able to stretch themselves. There's a Cambridge City butcher who is also trying to stay afloat by taking on a new delivery service. It doesn't come so much a surprise as a huge relief that local independents are the ones being most creative and responsive to local needs. Our small village has had the help of a Cambridge wholesaler in getting a weekly produce delivery to our village hall, which we volunteers then take on to our neighbors' doorsteps. This has been a godsend for us and has helped the wholesaler too, who has lost so much business to the closed restaurants, pubs, and cafes. There is a sense of reciprocity and resourcefulness in circulation right now. We all have the same basic needs, and it seems we are capable of problem solving for mutual benefit. I find I'm enjoying meals more somehow, at least much of the time, despite, or maybe because of, the oddness of some of them. Never have we all had to put so much effort into preparing and planning and making the most of what we have, and it can all be diabolically frustrating and anxiety-making, even for someone who is comfortable in a kitchen. But sometimes there is also a new pleasure in making a little ritual of a morning coffee or a cup of tea and the meals, weird or not. In the years we've begun to think of as before, we always celebrated Easter in our house with Nick Rumble's glorious asparagus grown under glass on his small holding in the land settlements of Great Abington, a mile from where we live. This year, his spears are still breaking through the earth every morning, and he and his son Scott are still bending over to cut them every single day, one spear at a time. They are carrying on, selling their fat bundles at the gate, a safe distance from the customers who come mostly one at a time to try their luck or pick up orders. I'm hoping this will be the centerpiece of our Easter table again this year, fate's willing. Whatever it turns out to be, our holiday meal will be a ritual of thanks for renewal. It's spring, and life surrounds us, making more of itself. We can hear the lambs and ewes calling to each other. The plum blossom is in full froth. And yesterday we witnessed a robin courtship ritual as secretive and wondrous as any exotic bird of paradise. It's not so much what's on the table or even what's lacking, but who is absent from it. A poem shared by a dear friend has helped me with this sadness, so I'll end my thoughts on Easter 2020 by sharing just a few of the lines from it that speak to me with honesty and hope. The poet is John O'Donohue, and the poem is called For Absence, from his collection To Bless the Space Between Us. May you know that absence is full of tender presence. May you be generous in your embrace of loss. May your longing inhabit its deepest dreams within the shelter of the great belonging. Happy Easter, everyone.
A wonderful piece of writing, and you'll be able to hear it again on our repeats, Sunday at 2 p.m. and Monday at 6 p.m., or on the podcast available early next week.
Wild Country Organics is doing doorstep deliveries to all CB postcodes in and around Cambridge and down to Haverhill, Saffron Walden, Newmarket, and also to SG8 and SG9 postcodes, which includes Royston, Barley and Buntingford. And you can search for your postcode in the wildco.co.uk ordering page. It will only allow you to place an order in the areas that Wild Co. delivers to.
Laura says that they do a superb bag of essential staples they've grown themselves. No choice, but all excellent quality to include basics like potatoes, onions, carrots, cooking veg, salads and herbs. It's £20 a week and people can sign up for regular deliveries or do just one. They're using bags instead of boxes so they don't need to be returned and are new each time. Malloy's Craft Bakery in Cambridge has also started a home delivery service. They can be contacted through their Facebook page or website malloyscraftbutchery.com. Cambridge Asparagus in Great Abingdon is selling asparagus safely from their farm gate. Order online or contact them at cambridgeasparagus.com.
Now let's go back to Rosie Sykes for some more rhubarb ideas.
The other thing I make quite often is a pink grapefruit and rhubarb jam, which is particularly delicious. It's not my own recipe, and if you have access to a computer, if you just search for it, it's a Chez Panisse recipe, and if you search for it, it comes up.
Oh, Chez Panisse at Jack from Jack's Gelato used to work at.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Jack was there. It's a really, really fantastic jam. The flavours just really go well together, and it can be a bit of a disappointing colour depending on what kind of rhubarb you've got. But if you've got the very pink force stuff, it's very beautiful.
When you left the studio probably about a year ago, you mentioned in passing, not on the interview, but just in passing, you mentioned this jam. And I've thought of little else since, actually.
Well, if I get round to making some, Alan, if I get a pink grapefruit, I will, because I've been getting quite a lot of rhubarb, and I've never met him, and I don't really know him, but he's got a business called something like Seed to Feed, and he used to work for Calixta, I think.
Yes, I know who you mean.
Now he has his own place called
Yes, Jake. They've been on the programme, yeah.
I don't really know much about him, but I follow him on Instagram, and he's had the most gorgeous-looking rhubarb. So I'm courting him to see if I can somehow get a hold of some, but I think he's based in Bedfordshire, so a bit further away than lockdown allows, really.
Yes.
But also, rhubarb is wonderful with ginger, and I make a really nice sort of flapjack thing where I mix equal quantities of melted butter, flour, it can be wholemeal, it can be any kind of flour, and oats and brown sugar together, mix that together, take about 2/3 of the mixture out and press it into the bottom of a baking tin, and then I put raw rhubarb on top, and then with the third of the mixture that's left in the bowl, I add same amount of chopped nuts. So I think Brazil nuts are really nice with rhubarb, and or almonds, whatever. Mix those into the rest of the mixture, and then I sort of scatter it on top of the rhubarb, more like a crumble than the base I've really pushed in, so it's like a pastry, and then the top is quite loose. And then you bake that for about 30 minutes at 150, and you get this sort of lovely flapjacky, crumbly thing. And in with the rhubarb, if you've got access to some crystallized ginger, or even fresh ginger, and a little bit of sugar, that makes a really delicious mid-morning snack, or a pudding if you can have it warm with some custard. So those are my rhubarb tips. I have a recipe that John at The Art of Meat has given me, which is a sort of rhubarb pudding with coconut and golden syrup, which he absolutely swears by, and I really want to make, but I have a feeling that it's going to be on the diabetic coma range, so I've got to do it when there are lots of people around, A, so that I don't fall into B, the diabetic coma, but B, mainly so that they can all eat it as well.
Well, something to look forward to.
Exactly. I do love rhubarb. Fabulous thing. And the other thing, actually, that I have done with it is baked it with pork. It's very, very nice. So if you were doing a pork belly, you know, it kind of cuts through the fat a little bit. Those are my tips.
Right, well, thank you very much. Well, some things to look forward to there.
Now for the results of some food history research that Sue has been carrying out. The first uses a herb called tansy, which is not easily come by at the best of times, so certainly not easy to find now. However, Sue does suggest an alternative.
This is actually based on a herb called tansy that has button yellow flowers, and they have various charming folk nicknames: bitter buttons, cow bitter, golden buttons. But it's the leaves that are typically used to make a tansy pudding or cake. This pudding, in fact, is a cross between an omelette and a batter pudding. It was typically eaten at the end of Lent because it was a bit of a mild purgative. It was suggested that it could purge you of worms and relieve flatulence and all other sorts of charming things. The herb itself potentially is mildly poisonous, although my research suggests that when you eat the new leaves in the spring, actually they're not poisonous. And I've actually got an early recipe from 1594 in a book called The Huswife's Handmaid. And this dish actually included crushed tansy leaves, feverfew, which is also a herb, grape juice, violets and parsley, and that was mixed with egg and sugar. In fact, it was originally fried a bit more like a pancake, but then later tansies were baked in public bakehouses, and actually different recipes were used, some of which never included the tansy herb. Different types of ingredients, ground almonds, rose syrup, breadcrumbs, grated nutmeg, brandy, or quantity of cream and butter were actually used in some of the recipes. Some of them use spinach juice instead of tansy to give this tansy dish a green colour. And there's a lovely recipe from 1660 in The Accomplished Cook by Robert May. And I shall read this out to you as the recipe was written. And it's really rather beautiful. So this is to make a tansy the best way. So you take 20 eggs, take away 5 whites, strain them with a quart of good thick sweet cream, and put to it grated nutmeg, a race of ginger grated, as much cinnamon beaten fine, and a penny white loaf grated also. Mix them all together with a little salt, then stamp some green wheat with some tansy herbs. Strain it into the cream and eggs and stir all together. Then take a clean frying pan and a quarter pound of butter, melt it and put in the tansy, and stir it continuously over the fire with ladle, and then chop it and break it as it thickens. And being well incorporated, put it out of the pan into a dish and chop it very fine. Then make the frying pan very clean and put in it some more butter, melt it and fry it whole or in spoonfuls. Being finely fried on both sides, then dish it up and sprinkle it with rose vinegar, grape verjuice, which is young grape juice, elder vinegar, cowslip vinegar, or the juice of 3 or 4 oranges, and stew on a good store of fine sugar. That actually sounds really quite nice. I think perhaps once I've picked my small fresh tansy leaves, I will actually have a go at making that recipe myself. This is something that actually was eaten right up until Victorian times, and it was almost considered as essential at Easter as mince pies at Christmas. So it is actually worth trying as a spring dish. There's actually a dish that might be slightly more to modern taste with less sugar and butter in it, which is actually suggested to me by local British herb kitchen founder Victoria McNeil. And she mentions a spring style omelette called herbalate or herbalate, originally based around 18 different herbs. And this is probably from the first English manuscript recipe book, The Form of Curry, which is the form of cooking rather than curry, written in 1390. She has updated it and it's on her website, and she uses lovage, a herb called dittander, lemon verbena, marjoram, parsley, fennel, savory and mint. As Victoria's actually said, the shame is our culinary heritage of herbs has really rather slipped off the radar. And I'll leave you with another idea for a spring dish, which is from the proper new book of cookery, 1545. And this is called a tart of flowers. And this could be made with borage flowers or marigold or primroses and cowslip using a custard style mixture in a pastry shell. That could look really rather pretty. I've also had a go at making a salad, as suggested by Steve Thompson, the foraging chef, using some primroses. It actually tasted really rather nice. So have a go, try something interesting, try something a bit different, go back to our food heritage and see what you like. Do try them safely, and if you're going to forage, forage safely too.
If you missed the recipe for primrose salad, it's in our last programme, and it's available now as a podcast from wherever you get your podcasts from, and also from the Cambridge 105 Radio website.
Some more news now. Moonshine Brewery delivers its beers to your doors on Friday. To get details of what is available, you can email mark@moonshinebrewery.co.uk. And some sad news from Heidi White. This year's Eat Cambridge has been cancelled, a big blow to many people.
Meadows in Eltersley Avenue has reopened after Susanna's 2 weeks of self-isolation.
And Cambridge City Food Banks needs donations of food. Their main needs at the moment are UHT milk, pulses, noodles, pasta sauce, tinned tomatoes, long-life sponges, long-life fruit juice or squash, tinned pasta, cooking oil, max of 1 litre but 500 mils are preferred, soap, antibacterial surface spray, toilet rolls, hand sanitizer, and bags for life. Drop-off points are listed on their webpage.
The lockdown has led to an increase in the number of people wanting to grow their own food, and it's also given a lot of people the time to start doing it. It's much easier if you have a garden, but I asked Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments what you should do if you're limited to a balcony, a patio, or a small amount of shared garden.
When you're in a balcony or patio situation, then you're really restricted to growing in containers. But, you know, if you've got anywhere that gets sunshine for half the day or more, then you've got a good chance of growing quite a wide range of food crops, and it's certainly worth giving a go. I mean, make use of all the space you've got. I think the most important thing to say about growing in containers is that watering is really important. They do tend to dry out. And also feeding. So, you know, hopefully you're going to plant in good quality compost, which will feed them for the first month or two. But that those nutrients are going to run out. So if you're growing a sort of hungry crop like tomatoes or potatoes, then you're going to have to add some feed during the later stages of the growth, especially when the flowers and fruit are falling on tomatoes.
Will urinating into the containers suffice?
That would suffice for some nutrients. That's going to be high in nitrogen. I'd probably recommend diluting it a little before weeing directly in, well, rather than weeing directly into the containers. I would say about on the balcony, it's likely to be quite windy up there. And actually, some patio locations are very windy. Mine is sometimes, and that will topple plants. You know, so you've got a tomato plant that's top heavy with fruit and windy night, and it's on the floor, and you've lost half the fruit. So be prepared for that. That means preparing some supports like wires tied in, attached to the walls, or perhaps tied onto the railings around your balcony. You're probably going to be buying in compost. Please use peat-free compost. Most commercial composts have got a proportion of peat in them, and that's mined from, you know, sphagnum and moss bogs, which are an extremely valuable natural resource that literally take tens of thousands of years to form. They're really special places for wildlife, and also they're really considerable carbon sinks as well. So just look for peat-free on the label when you're buying compost. It's certainly a frequently asked question by people who are living in rented accommodation. There's a house which has a garden, and the tenants ask the landlord if they can dig it and make a vegetable patch, and the landlord says no. So my first inclination would be to ask the landlord nicely and point out that, you know, you're not going to be doing anything destructive. It's actually going to contribute to the garden. It could well be seen as a plus point for potential future tenants who are looking around the property. Oh, we've always got a vegetable patch. That's fantastic, you know. And you could even promise to, I don't know, turf it over again if the landlord wants when you leave the property.
But people who haven't been doing this sort of thing probably haven't got the equipment, have they? Is it possible, you know, spades and stuff? Can they be bought at the moment?
That's a good point. I mean, you might not need a spade if you're growing in containers, but you're certainly going to need the containers, large pots, and I would say the larger the better, mostly because of this issue of watering. You know, the more water you can leave a plant with, then the better. So what are you going to need? You're going to need containers, pots. Well, there might be some lying around. Maybe neighbours who aren't using their stuff anymore can give you. When it comes to buying stuff, obviously ordering online is the way to go these days. You're also going to need compost. You're going to need some plants and some seeds, and you're going to need something to feed the plants with, because the compost loses nutrition after a month or two. And you're going to need water. And that's one area where you can help yourself. So look at your situation, the balcony or the patio or the... I think, is there anywhere I can collect rainwater from? Get a rainwater butt. Get two rainwater butts. You can fit diverters into downpipes that are very simple and clever little devices that fill the water butt up. And then when that's full, the rest of the water goes down the downpipe into the sewage system like it would anyway. So in terms of actually obtaining these things, well, garden centres are shut, but the obvious thing to do is to order online. There's going to be a huge demand. Do it today. Okay. One other idea, though, is that it may be that some of your neighbours or friends have got growing equipment that they're not using, they're not planning to. Ask around on your local networks.
What about what to grow?
So my top tip is to grow only what you like to eat. In veg growing, like something like growing cauliflower is quite a challenge, and growing that in a container is even more of a challenge. So, but if you don't like cauliflower, don't even try. Yeah. Seriously.
Cauliflowers also take ages to grow.
Absolutely, they do. And I suppose that's a very good point. So some cauliflowers take over a year to come to mature. It's much easier to grow something like salads and radish. I mean, and radishes are the quickest. Radishes will crop in a month. And if you're trying to get children interested in growing food, then I would put a few radishes in, just because, you know, they've got such short attention spans. I mean, even a month is a long time, but at least that's the quickest veg you can do. Lettuces and rocket, they'll all do well in a balcony or patio. Don't need enormous containers. I think herbs are a good choice. So anything like chives, parsley, coriander, thyme, they grow well in pots. And it's really, I think if you are going to grow anything, perhaps salads and herbs is what to go for. If you wanted to grow like rosemary and sage, then that's perfectly possible, but they're going to need a larger pot. Basil is probably my favourite herb. It's a little bit delicate, so I'd grow several pots, put one eye on the balcony and put the others on the windowsill, maybe, where they'll be more protected. Other things that do well in pots, beetroot, carrots. I mean, obviously with carrots, you're going to need to have a reasonably deep pot. Strawberries are a good one. Cucumber and courgettes will do fine in big pots with plenty of feed and plenty of water. Just make sure you get bush varieties. Chili peppers, again, quite popular. They should grow well in a relatively small pot as long as you get plenty of sun and you feed them. They may also do well on the windowsill. So if you've got a few plants, you know, put some on the windowsill, some outside, and compare how they get on. Tomatoes, obviously really popular. Lots of people like to grow them. Bearing in mind what we said about wind, tomatoes that grow up with a stick support are obviously going to be vulnerable to getting blown over. Use a very large pot, which is going to be heavy in itself, but maybe put some bricks or pieces of iron or whatever you've got that's heavy in the bottom of the pot before you fill it with compost. Another way to avoid that problem would be to grow bush variety of tomatoes, so that's called a determinate variety. I would generally choose cherry varieties rather than the big ones.
Yeah, they also ripen faster, don't they? They're ready sooner than the big ones. And are seeds readily available online?
Well, suppliers will be under a lot of pressure, Alan. That's why I suggest order today. I mean, try any garden supplies outlet. I mean, I would recommend supporting the smaller ones and those that promote organic gardening. So Garden Organic, the Organic Garden Catalogue, or Real Seeds, or the Seed Cooperative. There's lots of others, so have a good browse and get your order in quickly.
Any final tips?
Give plants enough space. So all beginners try to cram crops in. I'm thinking they'll get 100 large carrots, and what happens if they'll get 100 small carrots, whereas if they thin them out, they might have got 20 large carrots. Use the vertical space. You can build supports for plants to climb up. You can put a trellis against a wall. You could try hanging baskets with tomatoes tumbling out of them. And I suppose my final tip, Alan, would be once you've got the growing bug, you're going to need more space. So apply for an allotment. I know that there's some quite long waiting lists, but you might get lucky. And, you know, the local authority won't know what the demand for allotments is unless you apply and get on that waiting list. So apply for an allotment. You can go to allotments.net to find a site near you.
And many thanks to Dave Fox with some good and timely tips. Now for some final news items. Gorilla Kitchen is providing bao kits and now vegan bao kits. $19.99 for 6 bao, including garnishes and delivery. You can order by noon on Tuesday for Thursday delivery. And finally for today, Fired Up Pizza is delivering pizza kits, including the dough and the topping. Just order before 9 p.m. on Tuesday for Thursday delivery to the Camborne area, and before 9 p.m. on Thursday for Saturday delivery to the Cambridge area. And you can order via their social media. And that's all the time we have for today on Flavour. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sundays at 2, and then podcast early the following week.
We'll be back on the 25th of April, but until then, look after yourselves and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.